You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, we'll talk to a guest who says donating to long shot campaigns before an election amounts to political hobbyism, and that there are more effective ways for the major parties and for individual donors to spend their money. First, it's listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. Keely Boltina joins me now for Giving Tuesday, a global celebration of generosity and your time to take action. Set your favorite programs up for success in 2021 with your gift during our year-end member drive. Maybe you've already given this year or you make ongoing monthly gifts. Today, make a special year-end gift for the programs you count on all year long. Takes just a few minutes at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Just a few minutes, and today is the day. Right now, we have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $3,000. This generous match is from current members, including a member in Shiocton, and it means that they'll match every dollar you give.
That is their way of encouraging you to join them in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. Double your support right now. It's a great opportunity at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Federal and state tax dollars provide important funding for WPR programs, and those do come from listeners like you. Voluntary listener support is actually the biggest percentage of support for WPR programs.
You make the difference. You make the quality, variety, and independence of programs here on Wisconsin Public Radio possible. Because WPR matters to you, make a personal contribution to pay for the programs you listen to at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
During this member drive, we have a special gift. You can ask for one of the Reach Out and Read thank you gifts when you give $10 a month or more.
Your donation to WPR will power essential news and quality entertainment, and your thank you gift will provide books to young children during their doctor visits. Thank you for making a difference for kids in your community and for WPR with your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You may not agree with all of the opinions you hear from callers or guests on WPR programs. That's actually a good thing. It means that you're hearing multiple points of view, that you're fully engaged in a real discussion.
And it means you're informed about the issues because you've heard different perspectives. You can count on WPR for this kind of experience. We are listener-supported, and your gift right now keeps this diversity of opinions on the radio. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You first joined the WPR community as a listener, and you wind up tuning in every day. So after a while, it's time to join the community as a donor. Funding the great programs on WPR is a group effort.
We do it together, one gift at a time, $1 at a time. If you've never given before, start with a donation of maybe $100 or maybe go with $10 a month, whatever amount is right for you. It's easy to give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Our dollar-for-dollar match is in effect right now. I'm going to say that again. Our dollar-for-dollar match is in effect right now. We have up to $3,000 from generous members to match whatever amount you give during this hour of Central Time. So don't wait. Give now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552, and your support of WPR goes twice as far.
This member drive, you can also choose the Reach Out and Read thank you gift. When you give $10 a month or more, you'll provide books to children during doctor visits. Make your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We have a couple of comments from listeners here. We've got Linda in Windsor who says, I'm recuperating from an injury and Central Time keeps me informed and focused. Linda, thanks for tuning into Central Time. I agree. This is the place to do that. And Dave in Wanakee says, giving right now is more important than ever. David, thank you so much for that comment. And if you agree with David, now is the time to step up, to do your part, to become a member and support Wisconsin Public Radio. You do that at WPR.org or on the phone at 888-202-2552.
You count on us for great conversations every day on the Ideas Network. We count on you to help pay for it. Make your own very important gift right now. It takes just a few minutes online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your support of the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. There's a lot of money in our politics. That's no secret, especially during an election year. Hundreds of millions of dollars were donated to campaigns for congressional races alone in 2020, including some for candidates who ended up losing by a lot. That's prompted some Democrats to criticize their party's approach, saying it's spending too much on individual campaigns, not enough on grassroots organizing. Our next guest agrees and says that while giving money to a long-shot candidate might feel good, there are better ways to help build political success. And he says individual donors, big and small, can make more effective use of their resources. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you've donated to a campaign that you support, what went into your decision to do that? Do you think your party of choice should spend less on candidates directly, more on groups that operate outside of an election year? Have you worked with that kind of ongoing political effort, maybe at the local level, a little less, a little more unsung than the high-profile stuff? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Eitan Hirsch is an associate professor of political science at Tufts University, author of the book Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. Eitan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about this idea of political hobbyism, because that feeds into some of what we're talking about here. Can you explain what that term is all about?
Sure. So if you were in my political science class and you asked me like what politics is, I would say it's working with other people with some goal and some strategy to influence the government, right? Like you might try to get new people elected or influence policymakers, but there's a goal and there's a strategy. But for 90% of Americans or so, that's not what politics is at all. It's not about achieving goals. It's about feeling feelings or being intellectually engaged. And when we do politics as a form of intellectual or emotional engagement, that's sort of for instant gratification, I refer to that as political hobbyism. It has a lot more in common with like obsessive sports fandom than it does with politics.
And you see that driving donors, big and small in some cases, for Democrats, the opportunity to overturn senators like Mitch McConnell or Lindsey Graham, despite apparently being doomed from the word go. For Republicans, maybe the opportunity to try to vote Ilhan Omar or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of office. Some money went into those races. What is it that gets people donating to those sort of long shot campaigns?
Right. So whether you're donating $10 or $1 million, you can be really kind of thoughtful and strategic about it, or you could just press a button to make yourself feel good, right? You can be Tom Steyer and blow hundreds of millions of dollars running for president if you have that kind of money. Just like you could be sitting on your couch at home and you see a viral video attacking Mitch McConnell and you say to yourself, it makes me feel good to give $5 because I don't like Mitch McConnell, and that video gives me a sense of catharsis. And so when you're doing politics like that, donating like that, you're not really being like a thoughtful in what you're doing. You're just trying to feel a connection to that. Obviously, the internet donations that come through emails or in response to viral videos of campaign events or of congressional hearings is a big driver for this. And so as we moved, of course, to mostly online giving with COVID, that stuff took on a lot more prominence. People are getting these emails, really manipulative emails on both sides, political left and political right. Democrats are getting emails saying the polling is showing Amy McGrath has a chance in Kentucky, even though that's not true. They're saying these emails are saying, if you donate now, your donation will be quadruple matched. That's not a thing. So people are kind of being lied to about politics and making themselves feel like they need to do something. And they're kind of responding to that. They're responding to the provocation, to misinformation. And they're not stopping and thinking and saying, if I have a $10 budget or a $10,000 budget, what really kind of conveys my values in a thoughtful, strategic way?
Now, Democrats from progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to moderates like Alabama Senator just lost his election, Doug Jones, have been making the case that their party needs to do things differently. I want to give a listen to Senator Doug Jones here.
But again, it is not going to happen overnight. You got to temper the enthusiasm with reality about some things, and you got to get into these communities and work these every day, every week, every month. You can't just wait till and roll around an election. I think that that's been the biggest problem of Democrats in the South and other areas over the last 20, 30 years. We just go from one candidate to the next. We go from one election to the next. We really hadn't done the spade work that needs to be done.
And I think you would make the case that, Eitan, that whatever party you're part of, whatever cause you are part of, that's a smarter way to work. Can you talk about that?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you can't just come in with an election with all the money in the world and convince people to vote your way. Really, you know, the way you're going to win elections is by having deep roots to a community that you can connect people to your political goals over a long period of time. And what's happened over time is on the political right, there are quite strong social structures. First of all, the political right tends to be older and more importantly tends to be regulars at churches and in-person communities. Meanwhile, on the left, you have the decimation of labor unions over time, plus a kind of withdrawal from civil society, religious society, in terms of like, you know, the number of people attending a weekly meeting of any kind. You know, today, most people who are regular daily news consumers, most of those people belong to zero organizations. In the last year, they've attended zero meetings in their community. They report on surveys having worked zero times with anyone else on any civic or political venture. And so if your connection to politics is just online through following the news or being an amateur pundit and not in in-person political life, or even in the COVID era, in Zoom meetings with neighbors connecting to people, then you don't have deep enough roots to connect to people and convince them to vote for your candidates. And so, you know, we try to have band-aids when we lack those social connections. You know, a campaign advertisement is a band-aid, a postcard, a campaign, phone calls, and in-person canvasses. These are saying, hey, let's try to connect to voters we don't really know. In a one-off attempt to get a vote. But really, you're going to suffer in your political cause if you can't lay down a much stronger foundation. And what's amazing is that you saw, you know, whether you see this in Doug Jones or Ocasio-Cortez, who have really different policy goals, they've happened upon the same solution, right? Which is essentially there are no shortcuts here.
We're talking to Eitan Hersh right now, professor of political science at Tufts University, author of the book Politics is for Power. He says donating to long shot campaigns can be a waste of money. He says parties and individual people should refocus their efforts and their donations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has influenced your own decisions on whether or not to donate to a candidate you support? Do you think there are better ways for parties, for people to spend their money? Have you worked on a long-term local political effort? Make the case that it's a better way to do things if you want. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Eitan Hersh right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at Tufts University, looking at political donations, political spending, what works, and what doesn't work so well. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Franco is with us in Grand Marsh. Franco, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Rob. I have a question, and rather than ask Google, I'd much rather ask your guest. I've always been curious, when politicians run for office and they raise all this money for their campaign, win or lose, do they get to keep all this money for themselves and spend it on themselves? I mean, if you could, it sounds like you could get rich, win or lose. God bless.
Franco, thanks for the call. I think that's not at least what's supposed to happen with the money, Eitan. A lot of it gets spent enriching broadcasters, private broadcasters along the way. What else do we know about how money has to be disposed of?
Yeah, so that's a good question. If you have a lot of money left over in your campaign account, you can give it to a political party or to a charity, but you can't give it to yourself. So there are strict rules against that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Franco, at 800-642-1234. Eitan, you make the case in some of the pieces you've written recently about this and in your book as well, that people should get into not just that, hey, impassioned donation 10 days before Election Day, but to the day-to-day work of politics. And that could strike people, especially the political hobbyists you're worried about, as, you know, not big enough, too small scale, maybe too boring? What would you say to people to motivate them to do that important political work?
Yeah, so the first thing people say is usually I don't have enough time, but they're spending an hour or two a day on politics plus, you know, streaming endless Netflix episodes. So I know many people do have time, and that's who I'm talking to here. And for those who have some time, I guess what I argue in the book is that the local stuff is really important. You know, whether you're on the right, if you're on the right, you might think the most important thing going on outside of COVID is economic development. If you're on the left, you say on surveys, the most important thing going on are issues about the environment or racial equality. And, you know, at the state and the county level, a lot of decisions are made about issues of racial equality in schools and policing, about environmental issues related to transit and other issues. And so there's a ton of work to do. A lot of people think they live in maybe like a blue or red bubble, you know, in their town, but it's not true. When you start working on any of these issues locally, there's a lot of people that need convincing. And who's ever there trying is going to get more power than people who aren't trying. So I would say, not only is getting involved in politics very useful at the state and local level, and it's useful not just on, you know, solving potholes, but on solving big, big important issues as they affect local community, but they also help to break down this, I think, completely incorrect idea that we live in some polarized world. You know, you could be in an all Democratic area of your city, and the people who live in there, they disagree with you about the environment, about how to pay for reform and all that stuff. And so, you know, it gets us out of this cycle of thinking we live in this big country where it's good versus evil or smart versus stupid. Politics really isn't like that. And you can see it once you get involved. I have to also say that getting involved in real politics is so much more gratifying at a personal level, moving other people, being in community, that, you know, nothing on Instagram can possibly match it.
We are talking about how we can have an impact on politics with Eitan Hersh right now from Tufts University. He says, hey, that long shot candidate, maybe that's not what you need to support with your donation. Let's bring out another caller. Carolyn is with us in Pewaukee. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. I was calling to see if your guest today had any experience with the technique of deep canvassing and if he feels like that's a more effective strategy than a lot of the other things that we've discussed that are just sort of hobbies.
And Carolyn, have you done this deep canvassing before? If so, what's it like?
I don't, but my best friend works for a nonprofit that does it in Minnesota, and they were involved in a campaign deep canvassing for Biden this year.
Carolyn, thanks for the call. Are you familiar with this, Eitan, this deep canvassing?
Yeah, there's multiple chapters in the book dedicated to this idea. It's a really important idea because, you know, when in deep canvassing, you're basically having a real conversation with a stranger who disagrees with you. And what you bring to that conversation is a non-judgmental attitude, a sense of empathy, and you convey to the voter what's important to you and why, but mostly you listen. And it just looks so different than most canvassing. There are people who maybe they dedicate over the last few months, one night a week, to phone calls where they use a deep canvassing strategy, but on the phone. And, you know, maybe over the course of 2 hours, they have two or three conversations that are long, half hour conversations. They connect to a voter. And those conversations are more effective, more influential, have longer term effects on other people compared to any other form of persuasion. And, you know, what deep canvassing has in common with all strategies that are really strategic is empathy. You know, the book I wrote, I called Politics is for Power, which makes people uncomfortable. Like, what's power? Power is getting people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. And empathy is a core strategy in doing that. And what's so amazing is when you see politics online, like on social media, you see that the goal is not to empathize with another person to get them to move toward you. The goal is that catharsis. It's trying to get something off your chest. And so we see so clearly that in social media politics and political hobbyism, we're not building power. We're just doing something for ourselves. Where in a strategy like deep canvassing, we really are trying to move other people slow and steady to see the world as we see it.
Eitan, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Eitan Hersh is an associate professor of political science at Tufts University, author of the book Politics is for Power, How to Move Beyond Political Hobbyism, Take Action, and Make Real Change. Coming up after the news, schools are closing again as COVID cases surge, but not all of the schools are closing. We'll look at what's happening around the country and here in Wisconsin. First, Keely Boltina joins me for the Wisconsin Public Radio year-end member drive, day one on Giving Tuesday. You can support Central Time and all your other favorite programs at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
We have a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now this hour of Central Time. It comes from current members, including a member in Shiocton. And this is an incredible opportunity. It means that your gift of $50 turns into $100. $100 turns into $200. Get where I'm going here. Take advantage of this match and double your support for Wisconsin Public Radio when you give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Just had a really interesting conversation about what works in politics. Is it dumping a lot of money at the last minute, or is it the slow and steady work in communities over years? Probably bring that guest back sometime to talk more about his book. But it's a really interesting and I think a different look at politics than you see a lot of times in the headlines. And it's the kind of conversation that you can count on every day here on Central Time.
And Central Time is listener supported. WPR is listener supported. That means your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes conversations like this possible every day. So choose an amount that works for you and then make your gift.
You can do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. If you're a sustaining member making ongoing monthly gifts, thank you so much. If you're not, why not become one right now? Get it done before 2020 comes to an end. It takes just a few minutes to set up ongoing gifts from your bank account or credit card at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I may have just mentioned this, but we've got a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now, dollar-for-dollar. So now is the time. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Plus, ask for a Reach Out and Read thank you gift when you give $10 a month or more. Help get kids books during their doctor's visit. A lot of great reasons to give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at why some schools are closing again during the pandemic, some are remaining open, and how the courts are getting involved as well. First, it's day one of our year-end member drive here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Keely Boltina joins me to remind you that your support is vital to all the programs on WPR. It's the largest source of funding. Take just a few minutes right now on Giving Tuesday to support the programs you count on with your year-end gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
When Rob says take a few minutes right now, he means right now. Right now. We have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $3,000 in effect right now. It's a great time to donate because our current members, including a member in Shiocton, will double every dollar you give. There's still money on the table. It's their way of inspiring you to support Wisconsin Public Radio. So do it now. Double the impact of your gift at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Last time I checked, we were knocking on the door of halfway to that match of $3,000. We can get there. We can get there when you make your gift and when you get your gift matched. And you know what? You can get headlines and sound bites in a lot of places. But where do you go for in-depth discussions?
I have the answer. It is the Ideas Network.
Correct.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you. I like it when people say I'm right about things. Here, you don't just get like a 20-second clip or a few minutes back and forth. You get plenty of time to develop ideas and ask questions. Literally, you can ask your own questions on the Ideas Network. WPR is a great source of in-depth information. Your support right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes it possible.
Think about the things you spend money on every day. Important things like coffee and takeout, those are great. They do add up. It's easy to spend on things that are part of your, you know, your daily routine.
Wisconsin Public Radio is part of your routine, too. It's your news source, your conversation starter, your place to learn. So spend some money on it today. Start with a dollar a day. That's $30 a month. You can give at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Hey, it's Sam Sanders from NPR. Giving Tuesday is coming, a day when people all over the world give to organizations making a difference in their lives and communities. And all that generosity, it really adds up. If giving to this station is something you can do, then don't wait. Give for the first time today and join the global movement for giving back. Here's how to make a big impact this Giving Tuesday together.
You can make that impact with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It's Central Time. Rob Ferret here with Keeley Boltina. Your support during this year-end member drive makes the WPR programs you rely on possible. Your gift of $10 or $20 a month does make a difference, and whatever amount you choose is the right amount to give.
And really, the best part is that giving to WPR is easy. All we need is your name, your contact information, the amount of your gift, and how you want to pay.
It takes just a few minutes to make your contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio, and those few minutes fund your daily listening. Your support right now really makes a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You support the things that make your life more meaningful. Wisconsin Public Radio is one of those things. Here you get information about events in our region and the world, and you also get music and humor and storytelling.
You'll want a lot of news and information in the coming year. Your support now will make that possible. Make a difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 with your gift of the amount that's right for you.
Our dollar-for-dollar match is in effect right now. We have about half of the $3,000 they're matching left. Now is the time to give. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And right now, your support of WPR goes twice as far.
It'll go even further, actually, because this member drive, you can also choose the Reach Out and Read thank you gift when you give $10 a month or more. You'll provide books to children during their doctor's visits. Make your donation now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Celeste in Rockport says, I live in Massachusetts, but learned of WPR from a fellow musician and now love Central Time. Celeste, thank you so much for letting us know all the way halfway across the country. We so appreciate your support. Join Celeste. Your gift right now is so important at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank
Dale in DeForest says, WPR has literally helped me keep my sanity in these unusual times. Dale, thanks so much for your gift. Well, how about you? Day one of our member drive here at Wisconsin Public Radio, that dollar-for-dollar match still in effect. Your support is doubled. Got another just under $700 now. Thank you. Wow. We got a lot of gifts in the last few minutes. You could put us over the top. You can do it. Make your gift right now. It takes just a few minutes of your time. Support great conversations when you give right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Schools around the state and around the country are continuing to grapple with the question of whether and how to stay open for in-person instruction as the pandemic keeps continuing. Some states, like Kentucky, have gone into statewide closures more recently, while in Wisconsin, there's a patchwork of open schools, closed schools, some in between. Aaron Richards has been following this developing story. Aaron's a national education reporter for USA Today, based in Milwaukee. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
I mentioned Kentucky there. Where are we seeing some of the most stringent school closing measures, in-person schooling measures, taking place around the country right now?
Right. We've got a variety of states that have mandated closures. Kentucky is the biggest one in terms of a statewide closure, but we've seen other large districts that have either reverted to all at-home learning again. New York City, the largest school district in the country, was trying to get some kids back into school. That happened for a few weeks for some students, and then they went all virtual again, and then received a lot of criticism for that. They're once again trying to bring back some younger students. It's been a lot of back and forth and a lot of debate over whether a threshold of 3% positive cases of the virus is the right threshold to have kids in schools. And across the country, you've got about 30% of U.S. students who've never had the chance to be in classrooms this year because so many districts have started the year virtually. And even if they were considering trying to get kids back in classes before the holidays, if they haven't done it before now, it's very unlikely that they'll get any kids in classrooms before the end of the year.
At the center of a piece you wrote about this, Aaron, is the concept that we're in this patchwork here. States haven't necessarily gotten real strict guidelines from the federal government, counties from states, locals from counties. And so it's this mix and match approach we've got going on. How did we end up here?
Well, it's been a lot of passing the buck down the line, and a joke in the circles of people like me that write about schools and education is that it would be really tough to be a school superintendent right now. You're getting conflicting messages from both the health department, the federal government, not a whole lot of help from the state. And so this is also difficult in America because there's such a tradition here of local control. A lot of decisions about schools are made by your own local community, your elected school board. But your elected school board may not be as well trained in epidemiology as the local health department. And yet there's some skepticism about the messaging from health departments as well. And of course, all of this is tied up in politics, people's feelings about what's best for kids aside from politics. We all know that in a perfect world, most kids would be in school, seeing their teachers every day, getting that academic and social support. And even among parents, there's some debate about, there's some national polls recently that have shown that a lot of Black and Latino parents wouldn't send their kids to school even if they opened tomorrow because they're really worried about the spread of the virus in their own communities. They're concerned about safety. And there's a growing number of voices from those communities that are saying, look, use this opportunity to make virtual learning a whole lot better because it's where we want our kids right now because that's where we feel safest.
What have we heard from the federal government when it comes to encouragement to stay open or suggested guidelines or anything?
Right. Not a whole lot recently. And that's, of course, because there's a transition of power happening in the federal government. Of course, over the summer, President Trump came out very strongly for reopening schools. A few months down the line, I think a lot of people, even people that don't agree with him politically, actually kind of agree now that maybe that was the right move, but it was so politically charged at the time that I think a lot of people that might have come around to, you know, hey, let's get kids back in school safely and let's talk about how to do that, sort of recoiled from the mandate. Even Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, doesn't usually, I mean, her philosophy is to not, really tell localities what to do. She really supports local control, but you even saw her come out and say, get kids back in buildings. So that was the messaging over the summer. It has gotten a little muddy since then. And honestly, it's really come down to local health departments and even individual schools. I mean, in Milwaukee, where they're, the Milwaukee public schools have been virtual all from the start. There were about 30% of the private voucher schools in Milwaukee, or private schools that also accept kids on vouchers. Those schools, many of them did open for in-person instruction. And now some of them have made the individual choice to close because they're worried about the spread of the virus in the community. And those are talk about local. Those are just an individual school principal or, superintendent of a private school determining that that's the best move for their community. So very much these have been very locally led decisions. Except for a couple of these, both in Dane County and Racine County, there's some conflict right now between the health departments, saying that all schools need to close, both public and private, and the private school communities and an outfit in Milwaukee that supports, religious freedom and the rights of individuals are now, have a lawsuit pending on that because they don't believe that the health department has the power to tell private schools to shut down.
Talking to Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today, based in Milwaukee, looking at the decisions, the tough decisions about whether to keep schools open or reopen them for in-person education during the pandemic. Aaron, at the heart of this is the question of, okay, how safe is it for students to be in schools? What's the state of the art? What do we know about that?
Well, we do have some data from both Anthony Fauci and from the World Health Organization. Some of those have suggested that if you're the spread of the virus, if there's more than 10% positive cases in the community, you should really think about reverting to virtual learning. However, many states have had a far higher spread of the virus than that and have still had schools open. So that's not a hard and fast rule, but it is a recommendation. Certainly at the 5% positive threshold or under, there's pretty widespread agreement that it's fairly safe to keep schools open. There are, of course, some schools that are still offering in-person instruction and have been fairly successful at it, especially among younger kids. I do think there is a trend across the country now of some schools saying, look, you know, we don't feel like we can safely bring back our older students because we know that older students are more likely to spread the virus than younger students. And so we're seeing more schools target those young learners and also learners with disabilities that have a really hard time learning from home, trying to get them back in school. But other than those guidelines from, you know, both the CDC and the World Health Organization, you know, those really are just guidelines at the moment. Lots of states and districts are taking their own, kind of charting their own path on this.
One debate we've seen, I think since spring with all of this, is the question of schools as a priority. We've seen some countries in Europe and I think some communities in the U.S. say we're going to do everything we can to keep schools open, but we're going to balance that out to try to stop community spread by doing things like really being strict about, you know, bars and restaurants and other inside gatherings. Is that still a big debate as you see it, Aaron, here in the U.S.?
I think it is a big debate. And you certainly see people saying, look, even London shut down its pubs in an effort to keep its schools open. So if you want to try to, prioritize this, let's try to prioritize getting kids in school. That just hasn't been the approach that we've taken here. And I think what's unnerving for a lot of people is that it's such a fluid situation with the virus cases increasing that nobody really knows how far are we going to let it go before we take a different path. Certainly that has been a big debate in New York City with the schools being shut down a second time. And a lot of people saying, wait a minute, if you have the power to shut down the schools, why don't you shut down the pubs first? And I think, you know, some of that criticism is what has led the city to start to say, okay, well, let's try to get a few of these younger kids and kids with disabilities back to class. So it's complicated because it's such a fluid situation. It's overlaid with politics. And there's just not a lot of hard and fast guidance from above. And sometimes when there is that guidance, people rebel against it. So it's just a very messy situation right now.
There are the health concerns on the one hand and the community spread concerns. On the other hand, there's the question about, hey, is all virtual education, you know, bad for kids? Is it hurting their performance? I assume, Aaron, people are going to be crunching numbers on this for years, if not decades. What kind of signs do we have so far?
We have some indication that kids have lost some ground since the school closures in March up until now. The latest report that came out today has said that of about 8,000 school kids in about 8,000 schools whose test scores could be compared from this fall in reading and math to last fall, that reading more or less hasn't taken too big of a hit, but that math performance has ticked down a bit. Now, there's a big caveat with this latest report because the kids who were most likely to be tested were kids who were attending higher income schools that were more likely to be in person and that were more likely to have the resources to test kids even if they were learning remotely. So many lower income schools that serve Black and Latino kids were just opted out of testing altogether. And that gives us a bit of an artificial look. On one hand, it's pretty good that maybe more of our middle class kids are, you know, haven't lost as much ground as we think, but it really doesn't tell us what's going on with the kids who were struggling quite a bit academically even before the pandemic. There are other reports from both teachers and parents around the country that point to the fact that parents don't think their kids are learning as much online as they were in person. A fairly large survey of teachers that just came out a few weeks ago said, teachers who were teaching in person were reported they were making about, you know, twice as much progress as teachers who were teaching remotely, just based on the percentage of them that said that they'd gotten through all or most of the material that they would usually have taught up to this point in the year. So we certainly have some indications that, you know, remote learning may not be helping kids move along as much as we'd like to. And then we have to say, what are we going to do with that? Are we going to try to improve remote learning? Or are we going to just do the best we can, keep our heads above water, try to support our neighbors, and then address whatever learning loss has happened once we can get kids back in classrooms? And I think the problem with that is that some people are thinking that, you know, this might be a year where we don't get back to classrooms until next fall. And if that's the case, what can we do now to help kids learn if they can't be in classrooms full time like we'd like them to be?
Briefly, Aaron, as we wrap up, what do you have your eye on next?
Well, that was actually a great lead-in because I'm working on a big story about the extent of learning loss, what we know so far, what kids are most affected by learning loss, and some solutions and some suggestions from around the country that are helping those kids get the resources they need if they can't be in classrooms with their teachers right now.
We'll keep an eye out for that, Aaron, and watch your email for a request from us. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. It's always good to be here.
Aaron Richards covers national education for USA Today. She's based in Milwaukee. We talked to her about challenges around closing schools and keeping them open during the ongoing pandemic. Now it's the Wisconsin Public Radio year-end member drive. Keely Boltina is with me to remind you that you get great information about events in our region and our world here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's your support that keeps all of these conversations and our news pieces and more going strong. It's Giving Tuesday. Your gift right now makes a big difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I have more good news today,
Yay,
Rob.
Yeah, I like good news.
So we have had and met our dollar-for-dollar match at $3,000 from current members, including a member from Shiocton. So we want to say thank you so much if you've given this hour.
Thank you so much. That is great. You helped put us over the top, got us off to a great first day of our drive now. But don't stop now. We can keep going. You can keep giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I mean, in this last segment, we were learning about thinking about the decisions about closing schools, virtual learning, in-person learning, community spread. It's just an incredible amount of information and context that you get from these kinds of conversations that you count on from Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio is listener supported. That means your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 makes all these topics you tune in for every day possible. Choose an amount that works for you and then make your gift.
Well, and speaking of education, this member drive, you can help provide books to young children during their doctor visits. Ask for one of the Reach Out and Read thank you gifts when you give $10 a month or more today.
Support the programs you love and help Wisconsin kids get a strong start in literacy at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
My name's Kelly Davis and I live in Whitewater. I like Wisconsin Public Radio because it has this focus on all things Wisconsin, which is very helpful for learning the culture of the state. And then also, once you're here, it helps you feel connected to the community. I became a sustaining member of WPR because it was easy and I didn't have to think about it. And I knew every month I didn't have to make a conscious choice to do what is right. It just happens. Like if I am listening to Wisconsin Public Radio this much, I should be giving back to it.
To make a difference in your community and beyond, visit WPR.org.
Make your gift right now. Rob Ferret here with Keely Boltina on Central Time. It's the first day of our year-end member drive here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and you have the opportunity to help us stay on a strong path here. We got off to a great start. You can keep it going, whether you give $10 a month or $100 a month. We appreciate and we count on your gift.
The Ideas Network brings you so many important and interesting issues. I mean, you rely on these discussions, and that's why your gift during our year-end member drive is so crucial.
Help us put a strong finish on 2020 so we can continue to discuss these issues in the months to come. Make your year-end gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
The programs you hear on WPR make a difference in your life. That's why you're listening right now and why you listen every day. So during this year-end member drive, we're asking you to support your radio home.
Give now because you value public radio and because you want to give what you can to support it. That's how it works. If you're already a member, thank you so much for making WPR possible. If you're not a member yet, today is a great day to become one. Make your first ever gift. Maybe it's $100, maybe it's $10 a month. Give the amount that's right for you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Maybe you're a sustaining member. Now is the time to increase your support of WPR by $5 or $10 a month or whatever amount you choose. You can do that at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Robert in Madison gave. Robert says WPR is swell. Awesome. Philip in Milwaukee says, I'm giving to support the radio station I listen to the most. Thank you so much, Philip. Thank you, Robert. How about you? Make your gift because you count on us for great conversations and you know we count on you to help pay for it. Give right now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 and thank you.